is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they.
All of us in the anti-war camp were absolutely wise and right in warning about the consequences of this foolish and brutal war on Iraq. And the consequences of it are only beginning.
I think they should be ashamed of what they're doing, especially to girls that are so vulnerable like her. That's just what I was afraid of.
Poll after poll of people in the Muslim and Arab world show overwhelming admiration for the United States' form of government and even its culture. What these people dislike, I think, is our external policies.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, May 19th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A suicide attacker detonated explosives at the entrance to a crowded mall in northern Israel today, killing at least three shoppers and wounding 47, the latest in a series of bombings that have derailed U.S. peace efforts. We'll have more on that later in the cast. Meanwhile, President Bush said the United States is slowly but surely dismantling al-Qaeda despite a wave of attacks in Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and Israel. He pledged to pursue Middle East peace but acknowledged it's going to be a bumpy road. Speaking hours after the latest suicide bombing in Israel, the president joined with Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo to recommit the United States and its allies to fighting terrorism across the globe. This is still a dangerous world we live in, said Bush, and clearly the attack on Saudi Arabia means we have to be alert here at home. At least 41 French, Spanish, Italian, and Moroccan civilians were killed in five terrorist explosions in Casablanca, Morocco, on Friday evening. The explosions took place at a hotel, a Spanish-owned nightclub, a Jewish center, a Jewish cemetery, and a Jewish-owned Italian restaurant. The incident occurred the same week as a series of bombings in the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Assad Abu Khalil, author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terror, and asked him how he interprets these latest terrorist actions, which the U.S. is attributing to al-Qaeda.
Well, I mean, it only proves one thing beyond the shadow of a doubt, which is that all of us in the anti-war camp were absolutely wise and right in warning about the consequences of this foolish and brutal war on Iraq, and the consequences of it are only beginning. If anything, I personally was expecting to be an increase in terrorism. The surprise for me is how soon and fast the response was. And what happened in Iraq has made us all much less safe and will become increasingly less safe as America continues to expand its wars and adventures in the Middle East and beyond the Middle East.
After the Saudi Arabia bombings last week, Florida Senator and Democratic presidential nominee Bob Graham harshly criticized the Bush administration, saying that the war on Iraq was a diversion from the war against al-Qaeda and the search for Osama bin Laden, and that because of that diversion, al-Qaeda was able to strengthen its forces. In fact, he said they used the Iraq invasion as a period of regeneration. Is he off the mark, or based on what you said, do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I'm very reluctant to agree with anything that Senator Graham said, especially on the Middle East, because Senator Graham was against the war on Iraq because he wanted the war on Lebanon and Syria. And he also had his own political considerations with which I do not wish to identify. But I certainly believe that the U.S. administration fought in Afghanistan a war of revenge and a different kind of war, but certainly not a war on terrorism in the country of Iraq. Those adventures, those wars have only increased the threat of terrorism. And I think that George W. Bush has unwittingly become a better recruiter for the organization of bin Laden than bin Laden himself.
Do you have any information about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda that perhaps has not been distributed in the mainstream media that would lead you to support, that would support some of your suspicions?
Well, what I find very alarming from my reading in the Arabic press is not so much the rejuvenation of al-Qaeda organization, and there is evidence of that, but in fact there is evidence that there are many copycat, imitating organizations that are sprouting throughout the Middle East out of anger at the United States. In fact, in Morocco, the government is not looking for the traces of Al-Qaeda, but in fact for the traces of three different fanatical fundamentalist organizations, all of which are competing to take revenge against the United States. Similarly, in Saudi Arabia, all people are talking about Al-Qaeda, but the Arabic press is full of articles about yet another new group that is close to Al-Qaeda in ideology and practice, and it's called Al-Muwahidun. So there are all these problems that are occurring, and the president is busy with his re-election campaign now.
Mm. And so you're saying there are actually virtually copycat groups to Al-Qaeda being discussed in the Arabic media?
There is evidence of that,
Arabic
absolutely, yeah.
Media. Mm. Do you think that suicide attacks like the ones in Morocco and Saudi Arabia are a predictable manifestation of the growing anti-American sentiment in much of the Arab world?
Would I'm 43 years old. I have lived and studied the Middle East. I have never, ever seen more mounting antipathy to the United States and its interests than what I see today. The only thing that I find comforting is the anti-war movement in the United States, because it has sent a message around the world that there are different Americans, and I think this will hopefully give some pause to those groups who wish to harm Americans, so that they can say that, you know, attacks against American civilians should be condemned, and that's something that I take solace from.
Mm-hmm. Well, would you say that the terrorists are not necessarily representative of the views of many of their fellow countrymen and women?
Well, that's a very good question. I would say, however, that there is so much anger at the United States, especially with the civilian casualties in Palestine as well as in Iraq, that some people become ready recruits for these fanatical, hateful groups that are harming and hurting and killing innocent people. These are the ones I worry about. The general public, in my opinion, are not sympathetic to these acts against civilians, and hopefully they will come out, as they do in Arabic all the time, against them. But what is very worrisome is that lines are being blurred and distinctions are being obscured by virtue of the blood and the carnage in Palestine as well as in Iraq and other places.
And to those Americans and Westerners who say that these terrorist attacks, these ongoing terrorist attacks, only prove that the Bush administration was right and that we need to launch this war on terrorism, and that, no, it's not going to be over overnight. It's going to take some time, but that it's a legitimate war. What is your response to that?
I think this so-called war on terrorism has increased terrorism, and that's the irony of it, because they go about it by brute force and sheer massive deployment of forces, and basically they refuse to address the climate of the region that has provided elements to go and join these fanatical groups.
So how do you prevent these terrorist attacks from occurring? Bush's declaration of war on terror seems go ahead.
I think a good way to start is by acknowledging that people of the Middle East do not find American bombs and missiles over their head to be enjoyable. To acknowledge that the Palestinians also think of themselves as human beings, because many Americans, especially in the government, seem to disagree. They think that human life only exists on the Israeli side. If we come to those two realizations, maybe we will be able to reach a human understanding between the two sides.
But how would you articulate that in political terms and in real?
Well, I would articulate it basically in terms of rhetoric that would give equal value to the loss of Palestinian civilian life the way they do to Israeli civilian life.
In the context of the war on terrorism.
The context of the war on terrorism, and in the context of the statements that come out of the White House, in the context of the war on terrorism, I mean, what we can deal with is to realize that there is a lot of police work to be done, but also that wars and bombings do not reduce the specter of terrorism, but in fact increase it.
Okay. And so now, does it, just sort of to play the devil's advocate, does giving in to the terrorist demands amount to bargaining with them? I mean, if we start going down road, where do we start?
I never say that we should basically respond to the demands of Bin Laden. Bin Laden is a fundamentalist kook who wants to establish a fanatical republic, which is not different from the one we already have in Saudi Arabia, one should mention. But what is important is there are certain things, regardless whether Bin Laden says or not, that we should pay heed to, which is to end the suffering and the oppression of people in the Middle East. That's very important. But certainly I do not call for heeding the messages of these fanatical kooks. Absolutely not.
Asad Abu Khalil is the author of Bin Laden, Islam, and America's New War on Terror, and a professor at the University of California. A suicide attacker detonated explosives at the entrance to a crowded mall in northern Israel today, killing at least three shoppers and wounding 47, the latest in a series of bombings that have derailed U.S. peace efforts. The attack is in the town of Afula, and it was the fifth suicide bombing within 48 hours following blasts in Gaza, Jerusalem, and the West Bank. The spate of bombings underscored how difficult it may be to carry out the U.S.-backed roadmap plan, a three-stage prescription for ending violence immediately and setting up a Palestinian state by the year 2005. In Washington, President Bush said the string of attacks were aimed at stopping the peace process, but insisted the roadmap still stands. He called it, quote, sad and pathetic that some cannot stand the thought of peace. But just who are these suicide bombers and what's motivating them to act? Scott Autran is a research scientist at the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris and at the University of Michigan. His article, Who Wants to Be a Martyr, appeared in the New York Times several weeks ago. We spoke to him earlier today and asked him what the common perception of a suicide bomber is and how his findings contrast with that perception.
The popular opinion, and the one that's still promoted by the current administration, government administration in the United States, is that they're homicidal maniacs, crazed cowards who thrive in ignorance and poverty. But in fact, they're as educated and well off as their surrounding populations, if not more so. Also, President Bush, when he addressed Congress shortly after 9/11, said these people are doing what they're doing because they hate our freedoms. They hate our freedom of religion. They hate our democracy. But in fact, poll after poll of people in the Muslim and Arab world show overwhelming admiration for the United States' form of government and even its culture. What these people dislike, I think, is our external policies and the actions involved in United States intervention around the world. And that, you know, the United States Defense Department in the Science Board report in 1997 in response to the suicide bombing of U.S. Air Force housing at Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia stated that historical data show a strong correlation between U.S. involvement in international situations and an increase in terrorist attacks against the United States. But again, that's never discussed. What's discussed is these people are crazed lunatics. But if they were crazed lunatics, as most of the military men involved in counterterrorism would tell you, they wouldn't be effective and reliable killers.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the recruits are beating down the doors, so say our intelligence agents, to join groups like Al-Qaeda. Mm. There are so many volunteers that they can pick those who are most well-balanced and poised and most intelligent and able to plan and execute and keep quiet and not draw attention.
And there are some observers who say that the U.S. and British invasion into Iraq is giving birth to more and more suicide bombers every day. You describe these individuals as not the homicidal maniacs that some would have us believe them to be, but well-educated and well-off. And yet they have resorted to strapping bombs on their body in order to make a final political statement. Help us understand that.
Well, individuals within small group suicide attacks go through with their attack primarily because of their commitment to each other rather than to some ideological construct. It's the same dynamic at play that causes, you know, individual soldiers to stay in fight rather than to turn and run in the face of an overwhelming enemy. Rather than not wanting to disgrace their organization or family or country. It's the same dynamic that causes an individual to sacrifice himself to save his buddies. So unless the person is acting totally independently, this commitment to others in the group, you know, is operative, even if only two people are involved. So what happens is, again, as I said, the recruiting organizations, they go around to community centers, mosques, community gathering places. They start talking about their agenda. They pay attention to who listens intently, who stays after class. They ask around the neighborhood who doesn't have problems, who seems to be committed, And they select their recruits very carefully, weeding out those who are mentally unstable or have family problems, and also weeding out those who would do it just for the 72 virgins.
And that's what I was going to ask you about, the religious theory of the martyrdom that would lead them to have virginal wives or something in the afterlife.
No, I think, you know, that's a hang-up with our media and our own thing about sex and violence. It doesn't really have much to do with what's involved with them. What is involved is a manipulation of heartfelt and sincere family and religious sentiments. These kinds of sentiments, I think, are rooted in our biological evolution, fairly innate. And like our best Madison Avenue advertisers, these charismatic recruiters are able to manipulate these heartfelt feelings. You know, much like the pornography industry or the fast food industry manipulates our biologically evolved desires for sugars and fatty foods and sex. But they do it to ends that benefit the manipulating organization rather than the individual.
Mm. Well, there are also the reports that the families of the suicide bombers will receive large amounts of money, a payment for their actions. Have you researched that aspect of the suicide bombers?
Yes. Just like the virgins, people who would do it for that reason are weeded out. Again, they don't want people to do it for out of hopelessness or despair or out of any notion of material benefit. In fact, the Muslim clerics who countenance suicide bombing say repeatedly that kind of choice would be blasphemous and criminal. In fact, what they try to show is that these people have everything to lose, to live for. Look, people with the United States Defense Intelligence Agency, who I've been talking to and who have interviewed the detainees at Guantanamo, basically divide them into two groups, the Qaeda people, the Saudis and the Yemenis, the Saudis being more the leaders, the Yemenis being more sort of the foot soldiers. As far as the Saudis are concerned, a surprising number have graduate degrees, they come from high-status families, and they show their commitment in their willingness to pay for their long journeys to jihad, to give up family and friends, whereas the Yemenis are usually recruited by mosques, often in fact, in Yemen, and often in England, in places like Finsbury Park. But again, the leaders especially are fairly well off. Mm. The majority of Hamas bombers killed since the beginning of the Second Intifada in 2000, the majority of them have college educations. They don't do it out of despair. They don't do it out of hopelessness. They do it out of ideological conviction. And if you look at the history of terror, even the concept of terror, which was invented by Maximilian Robespierre, as a emergency measure to defend democracy by all possible means, including the extermination of all possible foes. And the use of terror as a state concept in the Robespierrean tradition is basically responsible for all the horrors and atrocities committed by 20th century revolutions. The only difference between these terrorists and state-provoked terrorists is that they don't have the state supporting them.
Do the families of the terrorists or the families of the suicide bombers know that their loved one is engaged in a potential suicide bombing activity?
Usually not. Basically, what they want to do, the recruiters, is create an intimate group of fictive kin, just like platoon buddies on the front line during a war. And they want these people to learn to commit for one another. And in fact, that's what they do. Over about an 18-month period of indoctrination in cells of 3 to 8 members, they come to feel for one another the way a father or mother feels for their child, or, you know, buddies in a frontline platoon. And they're willing to sacrifice their lives for one another in the same way.
Shortly after September 11th, there was this big uproar when late-night comedian and host of the television show Politically Incorrect, Bill Maher, said that the terrorist hijackers who flew the planes into the buildings had actually exhibited great courage in their actions of giving their lives for their cause, albeit a horrible sort of courage. Would you agree with this sort of statement?
Sure. I mean, it's exactly like someone who gets the Medal of Honor for jumping on a grenade and saving his buddies. The accolade accorded these people throughout much of the Muslim world is pretty much the same as what we would accord someone who won the Medal of Honor.
Is it possible to prevent future suicide bombings from happening? Bush's declaration of war on terror seems to many observers to be unrealistic and never-ending. And it seems that whatever actions powers like the U.S. and Britain and Israel take to attempt to squash terrorism are only increasing them and furthering the cycle of violence. What, in your opinion, can be done?
Oh, yeah. So to put it bluntly, one way of greatly reducing terrorism in the world is to end the United States participating in promoting it, as they do in supporting these corrupt governments all over the world. Another way is to start something like interfaith dialogue and negotiations, rather than saying again that these people just innately hate democracy because they're crazy or nuts, or describing it as a clash of civilizations, which seems to be a popular term that's had a large echo in our foreign policy community, and start talking about these things, not in sort of California touchy-feely ways, but in the kinds of dialogues that were actually going on between, say, the Palestinians and the Israelis up to the collapse of the talks back in 2000. Things were really advancing at all levels. For other reasons, they collapsed. But that kind of intimate dialogue at all levels, from the school level of children to the level of foreign diplomats, seemed to have been working at the time. And, of course, another main ingredient in reducing suicide terrorism would be to address the Palestinian conflict, which has become the focus because of daily images of violence in the media spread throughout the Muslim world. Have become the focus of global Muslim resentment. You can go now from Casablanca to Jakarta, and neither Morocco nor Indonesia were very much involved with radical Islamic militants. Today, at the kindergarten level in Jakarta, you'll find kids dressing up as Palestinian suicide bombers. So you've got to address that problem, and the United States is doing literally nothing. Talk about the roadmap for peace. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's about as serious. I teach in Ann Arbor, and our close community is Ypsilanti, and to me, it's about as promising as George Bush sending the United States Army to Ann Arbor or to solve all outstanding problems with Ypsilanti, or to Dallas to solve all problems with Fort Worth. I just don't think it's serious at all.
Scott Autran is a research scientist at the National Center for Scientific Research in Paris, a professor at the University of Michigan, and the author of In Gods We Trust, The Evolutionary Landscape of Religion. His article, Who Wants to Be a Martyr, appeared recently in the New York Times.
My name is Mohammed, but I don't know if it's true. We go any place better when our life here is through. But you have butchered my family. You must understand. And I will meet you in the promised land. I know it's not pretty, but for all that you've done, for all the widows and orphans, for all the wars that you've won, I must teach you a lesson. Maybe you'll understand. And I will meet you in the promised land. So I will get in this plane, and when it's in the air, to your symbols of power and our source of despair, I will look through the cockpit. I will steady my hand. And I will meet you in the promised land. I will meet you.
David Rovick's Promised Land. An Oglala Sioux tribal member has accused a U.S. Army recruiter of sexually assaulting her in his government vehicle on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation while en route to a supposed physical reevaluation in Sioux Falls. 19-year-old LaVita Elk passed up a full college scholarship to join the military. Now she tells Peace Watch correspondent Jim Kent that she has little respect for the Army and very little trust in anyone.
Native Americans have a history of serving in the U.S. military, from the American Revolution to Hopi tribal member Lorianne Paestua, who died while fighting in Iraq. Per capita, more Native men have served in America's armed forces than any other racial or ethnic group. LaVita Elk wanted to be the first woman in her family to join the U.S. Army, but her military career disintegrated on January 7th. That's the day her recruiter, Staff Sergeant Joseph Kopf, arrived at Elk's Pine Ridge Reservation home, unannounced, to take her for an overnight physical reevaluation. They only went as far as White Horse Creek Road, in the middle of nowhere, before
he sexually assaulted me, and he took me from my home, said he was taking me to Sioux Falls when he wasn't. He took me on a dirt road. He tried to rape me, and he completely denied it all. I was very shocked, because I never thought somebody I trusted so much could do that.
Elk immediately reported the incident to tribal police, who escorted Kopf off the reservation. The assault was turned over to the U.S. attorney, who declined to prosecute. The Army began its own investigation and advised Kopf he was not to recruit on the reservation until further notice. But LaVita's attorney, B.J. Jones, says after initial contact with Army investigators in January, there was silence.
So it's a little disconcerting. The Army has not really responded to my client as to what it's going to do to stop this from happening again, because I think she's concerned that this has happened to her. It may happen to others.
Lieutenant Colonel Bill Rosten visited Pine Ridge on May 9th to meet with Father Tom Simons of Red Cloud High School. Simons had requested that no Army recruiters visit his school until there was a resolve to Elk's allegations. Rosten was also scheduled to meet with Tribal President John Yellowbird Steele. Elk was invited to both meetings, but wouldn't attend without her attorney, who received no advance calls regarding Rosten's visit. Elk and her attorney see Rosten's visit as a public relations ploy to safeguard the Army's presence on Pine Ridge. Rosten denies this and says he's taken what administrative action he can against Staff Sergeant Kopf, who's been removed from recruiting duty and will be transferred out of the area within the next 3 months. Rosten adds that there's been insufficient evidence to bring criminal charges against Kopf.
So all that legal terms don't in any way indicate that I or the Army believe that something didn't happen, or that we don't believe Miss Elk's version of the events on that day. Nothing can be further than the truth.
Rosten says he'd like to apologize to LaVita, her family, and the entire Pine Ridge community, and proudly advises that a further investigation is being conducted by the Army's Office of the Inspector General after someone called them. That someone, it turns out, was LaVita Elk. Rosten admits that having recruiters drive alone with anyone enlisting in the Army has always been frowned upon. LaVita's mother, Geraldine, says she was upset when she heard what happened to her daughter, but has always been leery of military recruiters.
I think they should be ashamed of what they're doing, especially to the girls that are so vulnerable like her. That's just what I was afraid of. But I tell her it's best to talk about it. You have to let your feelings out. And she got counseling, and they started on some pills so she could sleep, and it's just very hard.
LaVita Elk is telling her story in hope that it will prompt other young women who've experienced similar incidents to come forward, especially those she's already spoken to on the Pine Ridge Reservation. LaVita lost her college scholarship when she enlisted in the Army. She says she's now applying to other colleges and trying to move on with her life.
It runs through my head day by day, and I mean, I just want something done about it. You know, just whatever was supposed to happen should happen. You know, whatever, like if he's supposed to be court-martialed, you know, whatever the standards are set for whenever somebody does something wrong, I mean, they should stick by it no matter who they are.
One step toward easing Miss Elk's dissatisfaction could start with Rosten and the U.S. Army personally apologizing to LaVita, her family, and the Lakota community, instead of doing so through the media. For Peace Watch, I'm Jim Kent on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment, and when we do, the late Alhaj Malik El-Shabazz. We'll listen to his words in the past and the context of today's politics.